Imagine you're just, walking up to a total stranger and perfectly forcing them to think of a yellow taxi cab, or like a specific Beatles song, or even just a cold pint of Guinness.
Right. And you're doing this with no glitchy smartphone apps, no hypnosis, nothing like that.
Exactly. Just six blank pieces of paper and a complete hijacking of their free will. You're doing this on the spot. And when you walk away, they will swear on their life that they made a completely independent choice.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of mind control you'd see in a sci-fi movie, or maybe, something that requires decades of sleight of hand practice to actually pull off.
Yeah. But the reality is far more subtle and honestly, a lot more devious. Which brings us to our focus today. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are breaking down an instructional text by mentalist Philip Shepard.
Yeah, it's a highly coveted method he calls System One.
Right. And our mission today is to take you completely behind the curtain. We're going to examine the collision of simple physical mechanics and incredibly deep cognitive psychology.
Because that's what makes this kind of illusion possible. It's giving you a behind-the-scenes look at how mentalists craft absolute miracles out of thin air.
And Shepard grounds this entire system in a very practical reality. Like, think about a working performer at a loud, chaotic wedding reception.
Oh, yeah. The worst possible conditions for a complex trick.
Right. The DJ is about to play a specific track, and the performer needs to walk up to a table and ostensibly predict that exact song. Or maybe they're at a busy cocktail bar and want to force a spectator to think of a specific brand of gin.
In those environments, you really cannot rely on complex, fragile props. You need a system that is indestructible, invisible, and ready at a second's notice.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because that indestructible foundation relies on something remarkably mundane, like literally just six ordinary business cards.
Yeah, the physical tools are so basic.
Right. Before we get into the psychological warfare, we have to understand this physical engine. You take these six cards, and on the back of each one, you write a number 1 through 6.
But the crucial step happens on the front of the cards. The performer secretly marks the blank face of each card so they can, instantly identify the hidden number on the back.
And it's not some crazy symbol, right?
No, not at all. Shepard recommends an incredibly minimalist approach, just a tiny pencil dot in the corner.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so for the card with the number 1, you put a faint dot in the top left corner. For number 2, you move that dot slightly clockwise along the edge. You just follow the perimeter of the card like a clock face for all 6 numbers.
Which is a brilliant piece of design, honestly, because it eliminates mental math under pressure. Like, if you see a dot sitting at the 3 o'clock position, you instantly know the back of the card says 3.
Exactly. You don't have to decode a complex symbol while someone is just staring at you.
So you're not sweating trying to do geometry in your head. Now, the performer stacks these 6 cards in a specific sequence. It's a cyclical stack, meaning the card marked 1 is on the face, and when you flip the whole packet face down, the card marked 6 is sitting right on top.
Right. And once that stack is set, the physical illusion actually begins. The performer shows the cards, turns them face down, and begins to mix them using a technique called a Charlot shuffle.
The Charlot shuffle. It looks so messy.
It really does. To the uninitiated observer, this looks like a remarkably sloppy, chaotic way of mixing cards. I mean, the performer is just dropping random chunks of cards over and under each other.
Mathematically,
it does absolutely nothing to break the sequence.
Right. And let's make sure that concept is crystal clear for everyone listening. Think of the 6 cards not as a vertical tower, but as a continuous loop, like numbers painted on a Ferris wheel.
Oh, that's a perfect way to picture it.
Right. When you perform a Charlot shuffle, you aren't actually scrambling the numbers. You're just spinning the Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
You might stop the wheel at a different point, but the cart with the number 2 is always going to follow the cart with the number 1.
The pepperoni is always next to the mushroom, no matter how you spin the pizza.
Exactly. And that continuous loop is the secret weapon. Because after the performer does this deceptive shuffle, they hand the stack directly to the spectator.
Yeah, they put the props right in the audience's hands.
And the spectator is told to take the top card and move it to the bottom of the stack. They can do this as many times as they want, completely out of the performer's sight. The performer literally turns their back.
Which is such a powerful moment. Put yourself in the spectator's shoes for a second. You are physically holding the cards. The mentalist is looking at the wall. You are dictating how many times the cards are moved.
So your brain naturally categorizes this as an airtight, exceptionally fair procedure.
But the math is doing all the heavy lifting. When the spectator finally stops, the performer turns back around. And in that brief moment, the performer just glances at the top card and spots the tiny pencil dot.
Because of that Ferris wheel loop we talked about.
Exactly. Spotting the top card gives you the entire sequence. So if the top card has a dot in the 4 o'clock position, the performer knows instantly that the card on the very bottom of the stack is a five.
And then they tell the spectator to look at that bottom card, right?
Yeah, they say, look at the bottom card and lock that number in your mind.
But okay, I'm picturing this in a real-world setting, and a glaring vulnerability jumps out at me here.
Oh, the thumb issue.
Yeah. If I am the spectator, and I'm gripping this small stack of business cards in my hand, my thumb is taking up a lot of real estate. What happens if I'm just naturally covering that tiny pencil dot when the performer turns back around? I mean, a mentalist can't exactly ask me to move my thumb without ruining the entire premise.
What's fascinating here is that Shepard actually addresses this exact scenario in the afterthoughts of his guide. And the solution is an absolute masterclass in invisible psychology.
How so?
Well, you don't freeze and you don't break eye contact. You use natural, motivated actions, which magicians call outs. If the mark is covered, you might casually gesture to the table and say, actually, let's make this even fairer. Set the cards down.
Oh, wow.
Right? The act of placing the cards on the table naturally forces the spectator to move their thumb, exposing the mark.
That's so smooth. Or like if you're standing in a bar with no table space, you could just reach out, take the stack by the edges, and raise it up to the spectator's eye level, saying something like, make sure you clearly see the bottom number.
Exactly. The action of taking the cards gives you the half second you need to spot the dot. But to the spectator, it just feels like you are helping them see better.
You build the solution directly into a helpful gesture. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it really highlights the psychological brilliance of letting the spectator hold and mix the cards. It just builds this airtight illusion of fairness.
Okay, so with that hurdle cleared, the performer now secretly knows the number the spectator is thinking of. Let's assume it's the number five. But forcing a number is just a parlor trick. The whole objective of System 1 is to force any specific item.
And that requires a massive psychological pivot.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is where we shift from physical mechanics to cognitive manipulation. Because Shepard uses a concept credited to Michael Murray, often called the universal force or the dynamic force.
Mm-hmm. Knowing the spectator is thinking of the number five is essentially a blank check. Let's say your goal for the evening is to force the spectator to think of a horse. You don't hand them a pre-printed menu of animals.
No, that would be too obvious.
Right. Instead, you create the menu verbally, on the fly, ensuring your target item lands on their secret number.
So the execution looks like this. The performer stands in front of the spectator and says, okay, if you happen to be thinking of the number one, I want you to focus on a dog. If you have number two, think of a rabbit. Number three, a cat. Number four, a sheep. And if you are thinking of the number five, I want you to think of a horse.
You have dynamically slotted your target into the exact position you already knew they were holding?
Exactly.
But wait, if I'm the spectator and you just rattle off a sequential list of six animals, alarm bells are going to ring. I'm going to realize I'm basically taking a verbal multiple choice test and you're just waiting to see which letter I circle. How does a spectator not immediately reverse engineer that you just waited for my number?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it entirely comes down to delivery and acting. The casual delivery is what lowers the spectator's defenses. If you recite those animals like you're reading a grocery list, the illusion falls apart instantly.
So you have to fake it.
Shepard insists that the performer must inject artificial fiction into the performance. You have to use pauses. You have to look up at the ceiling. You literally say, if you're thinking of number one, focus on a dog.
Ah, so you are weaponizing imperfection. By struggling to come up with the animals, you signal to the spectator's brain that this list is being generated spontaneously.
Yes.
And if the list is spontaneous, the fact that my secret number happens to align with the word horse feels like an incredible cosmic coincidence, not a premeditated trap.
That spontaneity is everything. Furthermore, notice the precise linguistic framing Shepard uses here. He says, if you are thinking of the number, he doesn't say, look at the number you selected from my cards.
Oh, that's so subtle.
Very subtle. By using the phrase, if you're thinking of, the performer subtly implants the idea that the spectator generated this number internally.
That is deeply manipulative in the best way possible. You are actively distancing them from the physical business cards they were handling just 30 seconds ago.
Because mentalism isn't just about knowing a secret. It's about rewriting the spectator's memory of the event so they feel they had free will the entire time. Human memory isn't a video recording. It's highly malleable and reconstructive.
Right. They just fill in the gaps.
Exactly. By the end of the night, when that spectator tells their friends what happened, their brain will have completely discarded the business cards and the other five random animals. They will simply say, "The mentalist asked me to think of an animal, and he read my mind."
They edit out the mechanics and only remember the magic.
Okay, so we have the engine running perfectly, the marked cards, the Ferris wheel stack, and this brilliant dynamic verbal force. But an engine isn't a car. How do we take this raw psychological mechanism and dress it up into a fully realized miracle? Well, Shepard illustrates this by providing a full multisensory routine in the source material called Final Destination.
Ooh, catchy name.
Yeah, and here the performer uses System 1 to force a specific location on the spectator. In the book's example, the force location is New York City.
Okay, so the spectator is locked onto New York.
Right. Now, once the spectator has locked New York City in their mind, a lesser performer might just dramatically announce, "You're thinking of New York."
Ta-da!
Right, but that wastes the potential. Instead, the performer asks the spectator to close their eyes and imagine taking an open-top bus tour through their chosen city.
Ah, you are turning a simple word into a lived experience. And then the performer starts fishing for what the text calls free hits.
Yes, the free hits are crucial.
These are vague sensory details thrown out by the performer that the spectator's brain will automatically validate. For example, the performer might close their eyes and say, "I'm picking up a distinct smell. It's savory, maybe street food, like meat cooking."
Because the spectator is already thinking of New York City, their brain instantly maps savory street food onto a hot dog cart or a halal stand. The spectator feels a jolt of shock because the performer seemingly tapped into their olfactory imagination.
Even if they weren't consciously thinking about hot dogs yet.
Exactly. What's fascinating is that even if the spectator was actually imagining the smell of, say, subway exhaust fumes, they will still accept street food as a valid hit for New York. A slight miss actually builds credibility. It makes the mind reading feel more like a fuzzy organic connection rather than a sterile data transfer.
Yeah, it feels more real if it's slightly imprecise.
Then you move from smell to sight. The performer claims they're receiving flashes of a specific color, maybe a bright, vivid yellow. Again, the spectator's brain does the work for you, instantly connecting yellow to an iconic New York taxi cab.
And the climax of this sensory tour is the monument. The performer describes seeing a massive, tall, gray structure. They describe the feeling of wind, the presence of stairs, and a profound sense of history. I love this concept so much. It is a brilliant verbal Rorschach test. You are handing the spectator an ink blot made of incredibly broad adjectives like tall, gray, windy, historic, and the spectator takes those vague words and forcefully hammers them into the highly specific image they are holding.
Exactly.
They map your words perfectly onto the Statue of Liberty or the Empire State Building.
Yep.
You never actually name the building, but the spectator is convinced you described it down to the brick.
This raises an important question, though, about the emotional weight of mind reading. Shepard includes a vital practical warning here, which speaks to just how powerful this kind of imaginative framing can be. There is a third towering gray monument in New York with a profound sense of history, the 9/11 Memorial.
Yeah.
Shepard explicitly notes that performers must be prepared for the spectator to visualize this specific landmark, which can and has elicited intense emotional reactions, including tears, during a performance.
Wow. That is a stark reminder of what is actually happening here. When you bypass someone's logic and play in the sandbox of their imagination, you are bound to hit real, lived emotions. It's not just a trick anymore. It becomes a really vulnerable, shared experience.
It demands a high level of situational awareness from the performer. You have to handle that moment gracefully or conclude the effect quickly. But assuming the routine stays in a lighter emotional territory, Shepard reveals a technique to elevate the trick even further after the reveal is over.
This is perhaps my favorite insight in the entire text.
The freebies?
Yes. The freebies. It capitalizes heavily on that malleable memory we discussed earlier. After the trick concludes and everyone is cheering, human nature just takes over. The spectator is so excited that they want to elaborate. They'll say something like, "Oh my God, when you mentioned the tall gray building, I was picturing the Empire State Building so clearly."
And the performer just smiles knowingly and says, "I know, that's exactly the building I was looking at in my head."
It's so cheeky. You retroactively take credit for the specific details their brain filled in. The spectator literally hallucinates a better trick than the one you actually performed. They will walk away believing you specifically named the Empire State Building, even though you only ever said tall and gray.
It is the ultimate psychological free lunch. You maximize the illusion without any extra work.
Absolutely. So that routine shows how deeply you can affect a single person. But to prove the sheer scalability of System 1, we have to look at the final, most complex routine in the book. Two gray elephants in Denmark.
This one is wild.
It pushes the mechanics to the absolute limit by bringing in a second spectator and true randomness.
Right. This piece combines a drawing duplication with a word duplication, and it relies on an inverted one-ahead principle. Now, the classic one-ahead principle usually involves the performer secretly learning a piece of information and using it to stay one step in front of the audience's assumptions.
But Shepard's application here flips that execution upside down. Let's break down the choreography. You have spectator one. Use the exact System 1 method, the marked cards, the dynamic force, to successfully force them to think of an elephant.
Okay, so spectator one is locked in.
Right. But then spectator one thoroughly shuffles the business cards, destroying the Ferris wheel sequence entirely, and hands them to spectator two.
And spectator two genuinely picks a card at random. The performer turns away and dynamically generates a completely new list of animals. Spectator 2 locks onto an animal based on their random number.
Which means Spectator 2 is a true wild card. You force the elephant on Person 1, but you have absolutely zero clue what animal Person 2 is thinking of.
None at all.
Let's say in their head, Spectator 2 is thinking of a rabbit. How on earth do you proceed when half of your data is entirely missing?
You pivot to the unknown. The performer pretends to struggle reading Spectator 1, the person thinking of the elephant. You say, I'm not getting a clear image from you, let's switch. And you focus your attention entirely on Spectator 2, the mystery person with the rabbit.
Okay, so you ask Spectator 2 to visualize their mystery animal as a photograph. You pull out a notepad and a pen, and you tell the audience you are going to draw the image you are telepathically receiving from Spectator 2.
But you are not drawing a picture. What the performer is actually doing on that notepad is writing the letters of the word E-L-E-P-H-A-N-T. Mm. You are writing down the force you implanted in Spectator 1.
So what does this all mean? Like, I have to call a timeout on this.
Go for it.
If I am standing 3 feet away from you, and you tell me you are sketching a picture of an animal, but your pen is clearly spelling out the letters of a word, my brain is going to instantly recognize the sharp angles of an E or an L. Isn't it incredibly risky? How does the audience not immediately bust you for writing text instead of drawing a picture?
It seems like a massive cognitive blind spot, but Shepard explains that you mask the writing through erratic physical movement and heavy verbal misdirection. Simplicity wins here.
How so?
You do not write the word sequentially from left to right. You start by drawing the P in the center of the page. Then you jump to the left and draw an E. Then you jump to the right and draw the T. You are mimicking the non-linear scratching strokes of someone shading a sketch.
Oh, you make writing look like drawing.
Exactly. And while your hand is moving erratically, you provide a running auditory commentary. You mutter things like, no, that shadow isn't quite right. Let me fix the shape of the ear here.
Okay, that's genius.
The audience has absolutely no real-world baseline for what telepathically sketching an image is supposed to look like. Because your verbal narrative tells them you are sketching an ear, their visual processing defers to your suggestion. They see what they are told to see.
That is staggering. So you finish writing Elephant, you fold the paper up, and you slide it into an envelope. You've now committed to a piece of paper. Then you look at Spectator 2 and ask them, for the very first time, to name their animal out loud.
Right, and Spectator 2 says, a rabbit. The performer feigns a wince of disappointment. They say, a rabbit. Well, I was close, but I didn't quite get it. We'll look at my drawing in a moment.
You deliberately create a moment of failure to drop their guard.
Yes.
Then you turn back to Spectator 1, the person you know is thinking of an elephant. You ask them to visualize their animal not as a picture, but as a word floating in the air.
And then you pull out a second piece of paper. You tell the audience you're going to write down the letters you see floating around Spectator 1. But what are you actually doing? You are drawing a picture of a rabbit, the animal Spectator 2 just freely named out loud. You fold that paper, slip it into the envelope, and the trap is completely shut.
Boom. When those spectators open that envelope, the reality fractures. They find a written word perfectly matching Spectator 1's thought and a hand-drawn picture perfectly matching Spectator 2's thought. You use the known variable to buy yourself the physical time needed to capture the unknown variable. It's a flawless loop of misdirection.
It's just a beautiful piece of construction. It proves that a single, simple concept like forcing a number from a small stack of cards can be scaled up to manipulate the attention, memory, and perception of an entire room of people.
It's an incredible journey. I mean, we started with the sheer utility of a Charlier shuffle, maintaining a hidden mathematical loop. We moved into the linguistic brilliance of the dynamic force, where inserting the word and distancing the spectator's choices completely rewrites their memory of the event.
Right.
We saw how vague sensory language creates a Rorschach test that makes people hallucinate specific details. And finally, how an inverted one-ahead principle exploits our visual blind spots. System 1 operates on the premise that the trick doesn't happen in the performer's hands at all. It happens entirely within the blind spots of the spectator's mind.
And, you know, stepping back from the context of parlor tricks, the underlying psychology of System 1 leaves us with a fascinating, if somewhat unsettling, broader implication.
Oh, definitely.
The core of this method relies on presenting a highly curated list of options while meticulously framing the interaction so the target feels they are exercising complete free will.
When you phrase it like that, it sounds an awful lot like everyday life.
It really does. Think about the digital spaces we inhabit. When you open a streaming app and you select a movie from the recommended For You carousel, or when you scroll through a social media feed and engage with a specific headline, or even when you choose a dish from a strategically formatted restaurant menu, how often are those choices genuinely independent?
That is a phenomenal question. Are we actually making free choices, or are we just picking the horse because the algorithm dynamically slotted it into the exact position it knew we were already looking at? We're walking away thinking we read the menu, but the menu was actually reading us.
It is something worth paying attention to the next time you feel absolutely certain about why you made a spontaneous decision.
A perfect thought to end on. Thank you for joining us as we unpack the physical mechanics and deep psychology of System 1. Keep analyzing the choices placed in front of you. Keep looking for the invisible pencil marks on the edges of your daily routines, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.